all who shall see these presents, greetings. I'm Adam Best. This is Veterans in the Wild. Reveille, reveille, reveille. Welcome to another show, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for coming back. We appreciate you being here. We have a brand new type of guest as we try to bring you here. We have one of those really scary people today. They are the nuclear-powered Navy.
Scary, not that scary.
They go under the water. They do something with, chemicals, things. Those sort of things, and they move their boats or ships or I don't know, but we're gonna have a lot of fun. I got a great guy here who I was actually just on his podcast. I have a great time connecting with him. We've been friends for about a half a year now, and we've hit it off because we've both been the junior officers. We both have the best fun for the very same purpose we joined the military, or specifically the Navy for, which was driving military ships. I drove surface ships. He drove boats, which are my favorite word in the English language. But we call them different things for the military. Here is John S. Rennie, folks. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Adam. Great to be here.
John, we typically start the show with the same question. We always start the show with the same question, but it sounds a little different to everyone. You decided, after 18 years of being taught things, being told things, being raised by your parents, you thought the best thing I can do with my life is put myself into a steel tube where there's no oxygen.
Yes.
Put myself under the water where there is oxygen technically, but you can't breathe that oxygen. And then I'm going to try to stay there for 3 to 6 to 7 to as long as someone else tells me to stay down there, specifically on the most specific type of vessel that stays hidden from everyone in the world.
Yes.
That was the best thought you had at that time in your life, John.
Yeah, you know, it sounds kind of crazy. Like, why would anyone purposely volunteer for submarine duty? It seems like a strange thing to do. And it's even stranger is that I wanted to do it probably by the time I was in junior high school. Before I went to high school, I had this idea that I wanted to be a submarine officer. It's almost like one of those things that like a kid will say, like, I want to be a firefighter or a police officer, or I want to be an astronaut.
Yeah.
But they never do it.
Yeah.
I had this weird thing that I wanted to be on submarines. I want to be the submarine officer. And I think it came from, I had two grandfathers that were in World War II. One was in the Navy, one was in the Army. But I think I was fascinated with stories from World War II, and especially the crews of World War II submarines and these daring missions they went on, and just all the heroics of the World War II submarine community that just stuck with me. I read all these books and I studied this history, and I'm like, I want to do that. And then of course the Cold War was on, and the Soviets and the US were playing games under the ocean with these nuclear power submarines, with their missile boats and fast attack boats. And you know, Tom Clancy was writing books, and I'm like, I am in. Ronald Reagan was president, and I'm like, let's go, you know? So, that's what I wanted to do. But, you know, I didn't know how to be a submarine officer. They said the best way to get in the nuclear Navy was to have an engineering degree. Well, I didn't know what that was all about. No one in my family ever had an engineering degree, so I had to figure out, all right, what do I have to do to get an engineering degree? So I had to figure out how to get good grades, math, science, go and get into a good engineering school. I had to, you know, be successful through that. I had to go interview to be in the nuclear power program. As a junior in college, I had to go interview with an admiral. And then, like, I don't know, I was a midshipman. I didn't know anything, right? And I had to get accepted in the program. And then, of course, I had to get through the nuclear pipeline, which is very difficult. I show up and like the brightest minds from all over the country are at Nuke Power School, from MIT and Stanford and all these great universities. I went to Worcester Polytech, a great engineering school, but these guys were like top notch. And I was out of my league, and I had to try to get through Nuke Power School. So I think in all that, what I would say is that it was very difficult to get to become a submarine officer. And every turn I made, it was like there was an attrition process. There was only 60% were going to get through, only 40% was going to get through. And so I just had to keep my head down, keep working hard. And eventually I did it. I eventually got my dream. I got to serve as an officer on the USS Tennessee. And it was absolutely my dream just to do that. And as we had talked about on my podcast, to drive boats, to lead sailors, to conduct missions. And man, I loved it. It was just a phenomenal time in my life. And I was living a young boy's dream. And that's not many people get to do that. So for me, it was like, it was everything I had dreamt it would be.
So I have to go back because I know this step. I don't know when Admiral Rickover retired. I don't know your timeline. I'm trying to go back, but
no,
I do know. No,
no, me, I did not have finish. To interview with Rickover. I was just slightly after he had retired.
And we have to explain to the listeners.
Yeah. Admiral Rickover was the head of the Navy nuclear power program.
Can you tell the listeners how an officer gets to be a nuclear officer?
Yeah. So you have
or to. Or even be, gets to be a prospective nuclear officer.
Yeah. So just to get into the program, you have to interview with the head of Navy nuclear reactors. And for years, it was Admiral Rickover. And he was notoriously. I mean, there's stories about how he would treat these midshipmen who would go to his office, and he would lock them in closets. He had chairs that were shorter in the front. He would take people to lunch, and if you put salt on your meat before you ate it, you'd be out. I mean, he would ask you trick questions, and it was all like a mind game. He wanted to test you to see if you had what it took to go into his program. He took it very personally. Now, fortunately, he was out of that role by the time I interviewed, but still, it was three star, I guess so. I don't know. It was a lot of stars, and I was a young midshipman, in my junior year in college, and I was very intimidated, even though it wasn't Rickover. I can only imagine what it was like if it was Rickover. But then I actually had to go back. I went through the Navy's engineer program. So after 5 years on the boat, I went back and qualified as a nuclear engineer, and I had to go through the same process, 2 days, 1 day written exams, 1 day oral exams in Washington with the Admiral and all that. So I had to go back 5 years later. Well, it was probably seven years later and go through the whole process. And that was just a grueling experience too. So, I'm not the, I didn't become an engineer because I wanted to be an engineer. I became an engineer because I wanted to get on the boats. So, I'm glad I did it, but it was never like a passion of mine. So.
And so we have to give respect to the next guy. Who was the Admiral?
I have no clue. I can't remember. like you're so scared. You don't remember anything. That was one of those moments in my life where I can't remember a thing. I was like, please accept me because I don't have a plan B. Please let me in.
Yes, because I think everyone who did either some commissioning source heard about the submarine officers or the nuclear officers going before the Admiral and just hearing those stories of what do they do to them?
Yeah. There was I remember when my interview, there was an 06 standing behind me. I had an Admiral, I was sitting in a chair, an Admiral in front of me, and it was an 06 behind me. I don't know why he was there, but it was just to intimidate you. Like, why is there a captain behind me? And I'm not even commissioned yet, So just one of those funny things that it's a mind game. Right. And, one of the things once you get on the boat, again, it's a mind game. They would, once we were submerged, they would have some of the young officers or young sailors climb into the torpedo tube while we were submerged and go to crawl in and write your name with a grease pencil on the outer tube door. And of course, while you're crawled in there, they shut the door behind you. And it's like a mind game to see if you are claustrophobic. And so As you can imagine, I'm not claustrophobic. So I just laid down and waited till they opened the door. I mean, what am I going to do?
So, yeah, I don't think you can be if you're on a submarine, can you?
I don't think so. No, whatever the opposite of claustrophobic is, like, do you like confined spaces? I like that. I've always enjoyed it. So, I mean, I have really fond memories of being down in the battery well. First job that you qualify as an ensign on board a butter bar, an 01, which is, lower than whale crap, right? The first job you can qualify for is a battery charging lineup officer. And that's the officer that makes sure all the ventilation system is lined up to be able to charge the battery properly and get rid of all that hydrogen gas so you don't, have an explosion. Yep. But I remember just fondly in that my first patrol, just, being down the battery well by myself, my trusty mag light, you feel the motion of the water and you're all alone in this tiny space, with a giant lead cell battery. it was like good memories, not bad memories. Like, that was cool place to be, like, not many people at that age, 23 years old, are in a battery well of a submarine out at sea. So yeah, a lot of really good memories from my time on board.
Yep. And that's something that everyone has to ask the people who go on boomers. How do you guys stay sane out there? You guys, from what everyone
you're assuming we stay sane.
How do you guys, I'll rephrase. How do you guys attempt to stay sane? Because from what everyone understands is you guys get underway, which means you cast off your lines from the pier.
Yep.
You go about 3 miles out. You blow the tanks.
Yep.
And 3 months later, we see you guys again.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen another Liberty port other than home port. I doubt it.
Yeah, I was fortunate to have a few.
That's what we think of the strategic deterrent sailors, is they just go out to the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, 100%.
So talk to us about
The other thing is, what's weird is we didn't operate with any other vessels. We operated alone.
Yes.
And that is, we were definitely like a lone wolf. Our job was to hide with pride and be ready if needed to deploy missiles. And it was a very interesting role that we played in the Navy. I was in during the end of the Cold War, so there was still tension between the Soviets and the Americans. So we definitely had a role to play. But it was, it's 5 knots to nowhere. I mean, we made circles in the ocean, hide with pride. I mean, it was a very interesting lifestyle. I mean, we stayed busy. We trained, we drilled, we stood watch, we ran our departments. I mean, it was just like a job, like any other job. But one of the things is we had the crew you deployed with. You were with them for 100 days. And then you come home, I did that 7 times. I made 7 deployments and, spent a lot of time under the ocean. And I just learned to really, I mean, I think the one thing I learned that I took throughout the rest of my life was people are so important, right? So the most junior sailor on that boat can turn the wrong valve and we all perish, right? So we were all in it together. We had to hold each other accountable. There was shared accountability. You might have heard a dog, but on my podcast, there's always a dog barking. But yeah, so there's shared accountability, there was shared vulnerability, and I think that we were all in it together. And that was really a special experience, because you don't have that same experience in the corporate world, right? You don't have, everybody's not in it together, right? If the business gets, the volume goes down, what do? You lay off all the factory workers. The guys in the corner office, they still get their bonus checks. They still got their air-conditioned office. Life is good for them. The only people that are hurt typically are the lower employees in a business. And we're not all in it together. And I think my lesson, what I try to teach people when I talk about leadership, is that we are all in it together. We have to be in it together if we want to be successful. So as I run my companies, it's always about that we're all on the same page, we're all in the same boat, and we're trying to do this together. I'm in it with you. So that's one of the biggest lessons I learned.
Particularly as I was joking you, I said, why would you want to go down somewhere where you have no oxygen? That is true, though. And something I left out was you went down somewhere where you have no oxygen. You have to create your oxygen. But a fire on a submarine consumes the oxygen you need. What kept you up at night as a division officer? I guess I kind of understand. You and I played the same roles. We were both junior officers. We both had sailors we were in charge of. We both drove ships in the middle of the night. I don't know if you ever drove a ship in the middle of the night because you didn't know either.
It was dark out, but it could have been no idea.
You always drove a ship from 7 to noon. Must have been so convenient for you, John. Jeez, I wish I could have done that, John. Ugh.
Yeah, well, it's all fun and games until you realize you can't, like, the only liberty we got for 100 days was, we called it eyeball liberty. You maybe got a little bit of time on the scope, and that was it. And you're like, oh, there's the sun. There's the sky. That's nice.
Yep.
But, it's an interesting world under the ocean, and it's and mostly I think because we were so alone, right? We had to rely on each other. One of the things I noticed, like in business, is that at least especially in corporate, is that we treated each other like the enemy. And it sounds kind of funny, but if you think about it, and anyone who's listening to this and is in a corporate job, you know that there's always finger pointing happens between departments. Oh, it's engineering's fault. Oh, it's manufacturing's fault. Oh, marketing did this. You know, there's always like the finger pointing. And my experience in the Navy was that the enemy was outside of the hull. The enemy was, thousands of pounds of sea pressure that wanted to get in the boat, right? The enemy was the Soviet boats out there trying to find us and track us. We always knew the enemy was outside the four walls, outside the hull. And as I've run businesses, I always try to push people towards that mindset that the enemy is not inside this building. It's not marketing's fault. It's not sales' fault. It's not in manufacturing's fault. We are in it together. The enemy is outside the four walls. The enemy is your competition. The enemy is, how about this, a sister plant that's trying to get funding for their capital equipment. We have to beat them to that money. We have to beat our competition to our customers. And that's the kind of mentality that I don't even know this, but it came from the boats. And it's something that's been, hardwired in me as I've led businesses, is like, let's focus on the enemy being outside the four walls, not inside. We're in it together. And I think that's, having that mindset is allowed me to be really successful with the businesses I've led. And it's not because me personally, it's just that I treated people with respect, and I tapped into that knowledge of the experienced employees on the shop floor, which is the same thing we did on the ships, right? You tapped into that knowledge of your senior enlisted, of your, that second class petty officer that just knew how to fix something, right? You talked to those people and you knew them and you had relationships with them. And that's what I brought into the corporate world, is just, being able to have conversations and have relationships with key people in the organization. I wasn't better than anybody else. I was just in a different role. I was the guy in the corner office, but that didn't mean anything. It just meant that I was, I had a different role to play.
It was at least past 2 a.m., which I always laugh because as you do, I have a college degree. And to me, 2 a.m. was always on the bars closed. Getting
right, a college degree. Right.
But when you join the Navy, you also, for me, that was another shift rotation. It was definitely the 2 to 7 when we were bored out of our minds. My eyes were literally crossing each other and I couldn't keep them open. And, the best part of all, one of the best parts of all the people is I kept you awake. You kept me awake. We talked about everything under the sun because I don't know if we'll talk about it because it'll keep me awake. I literally felt like part of the job on being the officer of the deck, besides, all the other things, mostly sometimes at 4 a.m, I figured out after a while, I knew how to keep the ship doing most of the stuff, particularly in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
You don't have to do a whole lot in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's not a lot of threats. A lot of the Java in the ocean at 4 a.m. is going, "Hey guys, are you awake?" But that doesn't work after a while. So you have to do stupid stuff like, you're off course by 0.1 degrees. And I played so many jobs where I just literally, I have a guy, I can't tell you his first name, but his name is McDonald. And I literally went, "McDonald." And he went, "Sorry, sir." And our game was literally like, how close can you keep it to on the exact degree? Like, are we on 350? And he was the ship's conning officer.
Yeah.
For, like, you guys don't do this as submarines, but surface ships, we go alongside another ship and we connect to them. We take fuel from the other ship. And we also take, you know, mail. We take supplies. We take food, all the other things. He was our guy to do this. But I wrote some watch bills, and normally I tried to get him on my watch thing so I could go, "McDonald's, what are you doing?" Because I had so much fun. And what that also made the whole watch was doing those stupid little things that, A, mostly no one understood what I was doing. I was literally mostly keeping everyone awake.
Oh, so we, you know, we had a fire control technician of the watch who would stand sort of, he would sit in a station kind of right in front of the periscope area where I would be standing my watch. I had a chair up there. He'd be right down right below me. So he's the closest guy to me. And one thing you would see on the fire control monitors is you'd have our track. You'd see our track. And it kept it for maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours. And then it would start kind of disappearing, but it was our track. So one of the things we did on the midwatch when we were kind of bored and, you know, looking for something to do, we would write our names in the ocean. So I would write my name in cursive, just make the slow turns. And it kept my watch station awake because they knew, because I was given commands to, you know, left full rudder, steady course. And, you know, I'm giving all these commands and we're moving all, no one really knows what's going on except the FT of the watch. And he's giggling. And I'm just like, "Would you shut up? We're just, you know," and you know, the captain's asleep, but I can imagine if he looks up, cause he's got a display in his stateroom of like what the ship's doing. Yep. And I can only imagine he's seeing like, "What the hell is Rainy doing?" But we, you know, we'd write our name in it. So I would write my name. I'd write my wife's name in this, you know, in the ocean. Yep. And that's how we would burn time, you know, and it was like it was a joke, and, you know, and just we all kind of did something like that to, I don't know, just to pass the time and, you know, have some fun, a little bit of fun. It, you know, it's harmless. Right. So, yeah. I mean, you see now, like these, these Navy pilots, you know, doing penises in the sky. Right. I mean, I saw that. I'm like, yeah, no, it happens. That's just normal. This is normal. This is normal military life. So
well, that's the funniest thing. So many people are like, "Why do they do that?" And that, and all the veterans are like, "Yeah, that's that's why.
This is normal."
Yeah, no veteran went, "Oh, what are they doing?" Like, they're like, yep. For the people listening, I'm staring at John, but he has two books in his background. He has two books written. The first one is "Eye of the Watch." I'm mostly starting there because this is a pivotal moment in my life. I took my first watch that really meant the most to me was Officer of the Deck. And John and I had this most relatable experience because this is the thing we most relate to the Navy. And this is probably the reason we both joined the Navy, which was driving ships or boats, whatever those.
Boats, yeah.
Whatever those flunkable things are. But no, driving a ship, driving a boat is to me an awesome experience. It's to me the big experience, the big gain for me was either especially taking it from the pier, so bringing it from, it felt like it was like taking a carcass, bringing it to life, and then selling it out of like the hospital was you bring the engineering plan online, you bring all the systems online, you start realizing like, okay, is the ship starting to serve? Like, is the engineering plant generating our electricity, or are we taking it from the pier? Okay, is the ship doing it now? Can we start, or can we cancel it from the pier? Okay, get that off. Can we start, like, are we doing enough things? Do we need any other, like, people getting on the ship? Can we get the brow off? I love doing all those things, but mostly it was, okay, we're done with all that stuff. Let's go.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and then also, best thing was, let's go into the vast like, not the vast unknown anymore. Like, you, the world knows where you and I are both sitting right now, John, of course. But, like, I guess it's still the vast unknown to our spirits.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I in my latest book, I tell about a situation where I had to get the boat ready for sea. We had a dependence cruise, and we had all these VIPs coming to the pier, and my captain had given me the duty to get the ship ready, and then I had the maneuvering watch taking it out the channel for the first leg of the dependence cruise. And he wasn't even on board the boat. He was still at his house, which was like an hour away, and he delegated the authority of that job to me. And I'd never done it before. I never did all that work by myself, getting the boat ready for sea. And I just remember how, you know, we have checklists and we have processes to go through, but I had never done it before. I'd done, you know, under instruction and all that. But it was interesting when he finally came to the boat, we got all the dependents on, and he came up to the bridge. He said to me, I'll never forget this. He didn't say, how did it go? He just said, how do you feel? And I was like, Captain, I'm just glad you're here. And he smiled, right? And then as we continued to get ready for sea, I look back at him. He was up on the flying bridge, which is kind of high. I was in like the cockpit area. He was on the flying bridge. I look back at him, and he was, you know, we had 06s that were our commanding officers. So he was an 06. This is his second command. I could tell that he was just taking it all in. Like, he was, like, almost like he knew that his time on doing this kind of thing was going to be over soon. And he knew that he was doing something that very few people get to do. And when I was looking at him, I was like, man, this is kind of a special moment. Like, we are doing something that not many people get to do, you know? And he had a smile on his face. Anyways, I remember, I did the maneuvering watch. I had been maneuvering watch OOD before, so I'd gotten pretty good at it. But I remember that was the first time as maneuvering watch that everything went like, you know, like in NFL, they say like the quarterback, the game slows down for them as they get more experience. That's what happened to me on that deployment, is that everything slowed down. Everything I did, I anticipated the way the boat was going to move. I knew the way the currents and the wind, it just all happened. It was magic. And I remember getting to the end of the channel. It's a kind of a complicated channel in Kings Bay, Georgia. I remember getting to the end of it, and I thought about it, and I said, you know what? The captain would ask me a question, how do I feel? And that was the day I felt confident for the first time. Like, I feel like I know what I'm doing. Like, I'm confident. It was kind of cool. Like he knew that was the question. And, you know, and I think that's the problem. We ask our people how to go or what's the status. We don't ask them how they feel, you know? And I just think that was a really interesting question we got a nuclear warship. We got potentially nuclear weapons and definitely had a nuclear reactor. And we're taking it to sea, and he's asking me how I feel. Really kind of a really interesting leadership question at that moment. So something I had to reflect on in my latest book, because I just think it was a kind of a neat experience. But like you said, you're going off into the wild, the unknown, right? I mean, anything can happen once you leave and you're off on your own in the ocean, and it's kind of cool. So yeah, it's a great experience as a young person to do things like that.
Particularly why I'm starting at the eye of the watch was, maybe it's my own experience more than yours, was one of my best friends gave me the deck for my first OOD watch. And he's one of those salt of the earth, kind-hearted people. He would take an hour and a half to explain every situation to me, or he would literally just, he would have stayed up the entire 4 or 5 hour watch after he did his 5 hour watch with me. He would have never given me the watch if I wouldn't have taken it. You know, yeah. One of those guys. He's a guy who, if I was like, Bob, I need you to drive down from Virginia to Florida at night, he'd be here in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only person in the world I would have wanted to give me the very first watch I had. But it was also like 15 minutes of turnover, which normally should take 3 minutes, right? For two professionals. So
yeah, like I would say it was a high five at the end of my time, but
yeah, at the end of your time, you're like, yeah, two professionals really should be like, threat, you need to know about this happening over here.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But the very first watch should take 4 minutes for a guy to really like, okay, what's up?
Yeah, yeah.
And I like, for a surfership, so I like, you start in the center of the ship where like all, that's what you'd think is like maneuvering. Or no, the control room. Then we have bridge wings. So I went out to this one, then back to that one, then back to that one, then back to that one. And like, even he could see, I was kind of like, I don't know what to do. Like, I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to tell you I'm going to take it. But I was like,
yeah,
I don't know what to do here, Bob. But as you know, he's like, well, Adam, I can't let go of this until you take it from me. Like, it's mine right now, and it's mine until someone takes it from me. And that's also like, I laugh about that because that was my first experience, but that's also a leadership thing. That's like, it's mine until someone takes it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, and the reason I named the first book Eye of the Watch, because I think when you take the watch, there's a responsibility that you have for the mission and the people. You know, like you said, we were never commanding officers of our respective ships, boats, but when we had the watch, we were in fact in charge of that ship at that moment. And so we had to worry about two things, which was the mission, right? What do we have to get done in the next, for us, it was 6 hours. And what do I need to do from a people standpoint? How do I protect the people that are entrusted, that are, you know, entrusted under my care as the officer of the deck, as the engineering officer of the watch? And I think that always stood with me as a very important thing to do. And as I came into the corporate world, and eventually my own business, that's the kind of mindset I brought to every leadership role, is like, I have the watch. I'm responsible for the mission and the people. Not just the mission, not just the financial numbers. I'm here for the mission and the people. And that's the mindset of a great leader, is that it's not just about the numbers, it's about the people in the business as well. If you think about it, great analogy, and I love this. I love, for me, I'm a sucker for all the Navy tradition, but if you think about a commissioning ceremony of a boat or a ship, right? There's always a sponsor, ship sponsor. And I was watching the Gerald R. Ford, newest aircraft carrier being commissioned. This was a few years back.
Yes.
One of the things the sponsor says that really stood out in my mind is she says, man our ship and bring her to life. And of course, right after she says that, they play Anchors Away and the crew runs up the gangplank. They man the rails, there's bells, it's like this whole ceremony. But think about what the words that she says. She says, man our ship and bring her to life. Without people, that ship is just a hunk of cold steel sitting in the harbor, right? Sitting at the dock. It's nothing without people. And I always try to tell that to people, because I think our businesses are nothing without our people, right? Our business plans are nothing without the people to execute them. We're going nowhere without a good team around us. And that's how we performed in the military, right? We had a good team around us. That's how we have to perform, you know, outside the military as well. And I think that was something that really resonated with me. And that's how I try to reinforce to as I'm teaching leadership classes and things about the idea that it's people, it's all about people, right? And you mentioned this, you stand those long hours, you know, stand and watch on the mid watch, and you get to know people really, really well. I knew more about the sailors that work for me. I knew about more about them than I probably should have. Like, I knew their ex-girlfriends. I knew that what, you know, foods they were allergic to, foods they hated, their favorite, you know, band. I mean, you knew everything about everybody. And I think once you know that about people, once you have those relationships, it's easier to get things done because you know what, you know, what makes everybody tick. And I think that's, you know, that's something I brought into, you know, kind of working in business, is that kind of mindset that we had on the in the Navy.
Absolutely. One of the things you were saying reminded me of, I don't know which admiral to accredit to, but he said the United States Navy is carried to the fleet on the backs of the United States, the chiefs.
Yeah.
And that sort of relates to, you know, who are the people, and that's literally the people is putting the ships to sea. Like you said, it's a hunk of metal until it actually gets there. It's not going to get itself there. It's the people that get there. Yeah. And like the admiral say, like, he was an admiral in a war, and he said, I don't do anything. The chiefs take our ships to sea. Yeah. And I'm so glad he said that, because I was like, okay, I need to kind of consider my position here. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It's kind of humbling. And it's also like, okay,
yeah,
I can tell a chief what to do, but a chief can also tell me what I should probably do.
Yeah, you know, the role of a junior officer is really crazy, right? And you've been through it. You show up to the boat, the ship, and you know, for me at least, I meet my department. I've got the reactor controls department as my first role, and I've got a chief petty officer. I'm 23 years old. I have a chief petty officer that's been in the Navy almost as many years as I've been alive. So, like, what am I here for? I'm this young kid out of college and nuke school and all this stuff, but I'm in charge, versus he's got all the knowledge and the experience, and he knows the sailors really well. In fact, as I looked at my department, my first department, I was the least qualified. The biggest risk to our department was me, not anybody else on the team. And, you know, I think that was a great lesson too. And I think that we have to learn those lessons and a lot of young people face it, is you might be in a situation where you have to be in charge of people that are older and more experienced than you. Right. And then how do you get that done? And cause you've been there, it's all about respect, right? Having respect for the guy with the anchors on his collars, for that first class, sailor that, you know, has been there, done that. And you tap into him, you spend time with him. You have to humble yourself a little bit. You know, if you come in and say, you know, everything, you're going to have a short career as a junior officer, right? You've got to tap into that knowledge and the wisdom of the people around you. And I think the best leaders don't necessarily have all the answers, but they know where to find the answers, you know? And I think that's what I learned in my experience, was like, okay, I'm the problem here. I'm the liability here, right? So how do I tap into these, to my chief and my first classes and really just get to know, learn how to do my job well through them, you know?
Yeah. And two things that made me think about was a lot of the watch qualifications, which defines like training in the United States Navy, or hopefully probably, I assume, the military, is most of the people who qualified me to be an officer weren't officers.
Yeah, yeah.
Or like, it started with petty or chief petty officer. And that's a truly beautiful way to do a business. But more importantly, that's also, maybe not more, well, on a separate light, that's a very beautiful way to create culture.
Yeah.
Because at 4 a.m, I remember talking to a guy named Selby who loved guns. And we talked about guns, which at that point in my life, like, I've always been pro guns, but he taught me certain things and like things that I wouldn't have thought about and things that now, like, you know, breath control, those sort of things that, like, also at that point, like we talked about before, they keep you awake.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Which is the most important thing at 4 a.m. when you have to go.
Yeah.
I have to stay awake. And for officers, as we both were, like, I'm in charge. I have to keep me awake. I have to keep all of them awake. So I'll talk about anything. So if you want to talk about guns or why a bullet needs to rotate as it comes out of the barrel, sure, I'll learn.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. We had an officer that was into the Andy Griffith Show, and he would talk about the Andy Griffith Show and different episodes. I'm like, I'm from the North. I don't know what you're talking about, but I'll listen.
Yep.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know who Aunt B is, but I'm going to listen to your stories. And I think, you know, that's the other thing too, is that, you know, we were, and I'm sure the same thing with you on your ship, is we were from all over the country, and we were diverse, whether it was religion, race, area of the country, upbringing, poor, rich. We were just from all over the place, you know, and we were locked in a metal tube, and we had to figure out how to get things done. We depended on each other, right, to do our job and then get home safely. And so, you know, I think I have a very high tolerance for people who have differences that, you know, who more different than I am. And I've always believed that, you know, we talk about diversity, and diversity is a big thing, but I think diversity is really super helpful in business, to having people who don't always think the same way, having different ideas, and we bring different things to the table. And I'm not afraid of that. You know, I like that in my businesses, and I don't do it because I got a quota to meet or whatever. It's more like, I want people from different backgrounds and different experiences. I like having young employees work for me. I like to have older employees working for me. I like to have people from the industry. I like to have people from outside the industry. I want to have this really crazy, diverse team of people who don't think like I do, you know? And I think some of the weak leaders want to have everybody around them that think the way they think, right? They want a bunch of yes men and yes women, right? I've never had that mindset. And I think it came from my days on the boat. I just loved, we were a strange family, you know? I mean, you probably relate to that. We were, you know, we were old, we were young, we were, I mean, mostly young, but we were from all over the country, and we were hicks. We were heavy metal guys, country music guys. We were in it together, and we had a mission, a common mission. And I think that's one thing that, I think as a veteran, as you come out of the military, you miss that. You miss that. Like, we're this really weird group of people that got forced together, not by our choosing, but we learned how to get along and accomplish really, really difficult things. And then we come into the, you know, a civilian world, and it's like, oh, this is not, A, it's not difficult. And B, we all hate each other, and we're all finger pointing. And it's just like, wait a second, there's a whole nother way to live and lead. This is not life. This is not right. So I think, especially now, I think, you know, there's a lot of division in our country. And I just think that, I don't know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Like, we're more in it together than we are against each other. You know, we're more on the same team than we're against each other. And I think that kind of mindset is we need more of, you know, in the country right now. And we're not going to talk politics, but I just was saying, that kind of mindset is really important for nations, for companies, for organizations, is that you're in it together with a mission to accomplish together.
The nuclear Navy.
Mm.
Those people are the best in the world at operating nuclear reactors.
100%. That's actually true. There's never been an incident.
What do they get right?
Yeah.
How could they, where do they get too neurotic? Or do they get too?
Oh, big time.
Too crazy.
Oh, nukes are crazy. They're nuts. I mean, I have a lot of friends.
Are you a nuclear trained officer,
John? Oh no, I'm a nuke. I'm 100% nuke. I'm a nuclear certified. Actually, I'm a certified engineer. I actually went through the engineer's exam and qualified as a nuclear engineer.
So they told you you were crazy.
No, I'm as nuke as anybody. But you know what? Here's the deal. And this is a slight problem with the military too, is that we promoted people on technical rating in the nuclear Navy. So they looked at your scores at Nuke Power School, prototype, and then engineer's exam. Plus they looked at your fit reps, right?
Yes.
But you got a technical rating. This always bothered me, not a leadership rating, a technical rating. So if you did good in Nuke Power School, which was all basically academics, right?
Yes.
Prototype, which is more hands-on. And then the engineer's exam was kind of academic. If you did well in those things, then you were eligible to be promoted and you were likely on a command track. And that always bothered me. Like I don't, you know, the guys that we work for don't care how smart we are or how much nuclear knowledge we have. And that stuff's not going to, at the end of the day, make a difference when you're in close combat with another submarine or a surface ship. Those things don't matter at all. And I think that always bothered me because I wasn't the greatest nuke in the world. I'll tell you that my technical rating was not that high. You know what the guy who finishes last place at Nuke Power School is? He's a nuclear submarine officer. Yeah, at the end of the day. So I passed all my tests. I got qualified, all that. But I didn't have a high technical rating. It always bothered me because, you know, at the end of the day, I probably wanted to command a boat. But I kind of knew that my technical rating being where it was, I was going to struggle getting the right billets to be able to get to command. So it was one of those things that it was a little bothersome to me because we didn't promote based on leadership. We promoted based on technical rating in the nuclear Navy. And I think that's a problem. I tell a story in my new book of one of the officers I was training. He was my junior officer of the watch and super, super smart guy from Georgia Tech. But, you know, he had arms this like this pencil, right? And he was a small stature. He was super book smart. But my first drill I ran on him was I secured hydraulics to the periscope and made him to go to periscope depth. And he couldn't turn the periscope around. He wasn't physically strong enough. And, but he had a high technical rating. And like, what the hell? This doesn't make any sense to me. Like, you got to be strong to be able to turn a periscope. You got to be athletic to do this job. It doesn't sound like but you had to be strong,
yeah.
Physically strong, mentally strong. And your technical rating means jack when you're taking a ship to periscope depth and you have no hydraulics. So again, maybe I get on a little bit of rant, but I am a nuke, but I never really fit the nuke, I guess the mold. I was always the maverick in the nuke world. Here's the deal. I got qualified as engineering officer of the watch. And the next day I said, when can I stand OOD? I just wanted out of the engine room. I did nuke to get to the boat, but I just wanted to drive the ship. That's all I cared about. So I was not the best nuke in the world. So,
but that's also a good lesson to like, here's my goal. That's a very, very big challenge to get through nuclear power school, to train to be a nuclear powered qualified officer in the hardest program in the world. Like, I would say the Navy's probably stricter than the civilian world is. And that's why the civilian world hires the Navy.
Oh, yeah.
So you went through all of that just to go, okay, now I'm here to do my goal, which is go up forward.
Yeah, it's true.
And
at the end of my time, I got qualified as an engineer just to sort of, at that point, I kind of knew I was getting out, but I wanted to say, yeah. And guess what? I can get past your engineering program too. I'm not a good nuke, but I'll kick ass on this engineer's exam. And I did, and I got qualified. So part of it was like, and I'm just showing them like you're thinking about this wrong. But I'm still going to meet your criteria, you know, and, you know, I don't know, maybe it's been a part of problem with me, but my whole life, I've sort of had a chip on my shoulder. It's trying to prove to others that I could do what people said I couldn't do, you know, and that's always been important to me is to prove people wrong. That's been my whole life. So,
but they've never had a nuclear problem. What does the nuclear Navy do really well?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is it's training, it's procedures, it's accountability, it's mindset. All that is written in. I think the other thing is training on, we really do debrief failures. So when there is a failure, we spend a lot of time understanding how things fail. You might be surprised to hear this, but sometimes we would run, it was like once a month, we did this theory to practice exercise where we would sit around and calculate or figure out what we think the reactor would do if we did X, Y, or Z. And we'd actually do it and we would monitor what would happen. And we would have this theory to practice exercise and we would sit around and think about, okay, well, that was kind of interesting. It did what we expected or it didn't do what we expected. So we would do a lot of, they hired smart people and they taught them really well. And I think there was a high level of accountability. And I think that's what led to, you know, us being so safe for so many years. And it's definitely a mindset of we hire the best, we train them really well, and we hold them accountable to do their jobs. And I think they do a really good job at that. So, I mean, I honestly, at the end of the day, I'll be honest, I should never have been in charge of a nuclear reactor. I was not that kind of guy, but I did it. Yep. I did it for 5 years. I was running nuclear reactors, and I still laugh about it today. I'm like, I can't believe I did that, you know? So,
so theory to practice happens at sea.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that stupid? It'd be like on a Saturday, we'd do theory to practice and the engineer would lead it and we'd, you know, he had like a booklet of things we could do. And we, as officers and some of the enlisted guys, we'd say, oh, this one looks really cool. I wonder what happens to TAV when, you know, temperature, average coolant temperature when we do X, Y, or Z, and like, let's see what happens. It was cool. I mean, the reactor was really robust. It was designed really, really well. And we could do some, it was pretty cool. It was, because we spent a lot of time shutting the reactor down, bringing it back up in emergency situations. And that thing was just, it was cool. I mean, you got the point where like this thing had a life of its own and you knew what it could do. And we spent a lot of time knowing how it, you know, how it ran and like it had a personality and we learned that personality really yes. well.
Awesome. So, For the sake of time, I hate to skip over so much of your 22-year career in the civilian world. But there's a lot more that is more valuable, I think, to our listeners. You've written 2 books. You now run a manufacturing company.
Yes.
We've talked about somewhat of your books. What are your 2 books? Why the 2 different books? Was your goal to always write a book? Or was it sudden motivation?
You know, I started writing 8-9 years ago when I was starting to rotate out. I was thinking about getting out of corporate life. And so one of the things I realized is, was that what?
You're a nuke and you just learned to write now. These nukes.
Please, you know, please
they buy control my book. Reactors, but they like scribble things. These nukes.
Yeah, I would say this. I was like,
please. I learned to write when I was 40.
No, it's funny because I never took English in college. For whatever reason, I was in engineering school and I took German. I didn't even take English in college. So my last English course was in high school. And I went, I have an MBA and I have a master's in manufacturing engineering. I never took any English courses after high school. So yeah, and I'm a best-selling author of 2 books. So for those of you who are thinking about writing a book, you can do it. I guarantee you. But I realized that I was a big fish in a small pond as an executive at a big corporation. Like nobody knew me outside of my business. I had a reputation. People knew who I was and what I could do inside the company, but outside nobody knew who I was. And so about 8 years ago, I started writing articles for different websites. I started a blog. And started sharing some of these. And I also began to realize that I had a really unique leadership background that I wanted to talk about. So I started writing, and eventually it led to my first book, which I wrote 2 years ago, which is a lot of different, people will say it's like a lot of common sense approaches to leadership. So what do good leaders do, and what have I done at that point in like 28 years of leading people that I found really works well? So it's a kind of a compilation of different stories from the boat, from my days in corporate America. And it's based on themes of what things that leaders should do. So each chapter is something that leaders should be doing. And then just this year in May, I launched a new book called All in the Same Boat. And that's a bigger book. And that's more, it's more lessons from the submarine and how I put them into practice in the business world. So in that new book, there's like 50 sea stories, and there's like, 20 business stories, and they all tie around 8 different themes. And it's a fun book. If you are curious to know what life is like on a submarine, this is a great book for that. If you want to know, there's a lot of terminology in it that people don't understand. Like, how do you make oxygen? How do you get rid of your waste? But they're tied into stories that'll make you laugh. It'll give you a good understanding. But there's always a lesson to be learned in each one of the stories. It's around 8 major themes. And I think the reaction has been really, really good. And both books are on the bestseller list. And the first book has been on there for 2 years, which is remarkable. And a lot of people like it. It resonates with people. And I go to colleges, I teach in grad school, and I do like leadership lectures. And now I've been doing some keynote speeches, and it's fun. So I've loved teaching people about the subject of leadership and trying to break it down into some basic things that everybody can understand. So it's not, and it's been a lot of fun. So, but it was born out of like, nobody knows who I am, in the real world outside of this corporation. And so it was like me stepping out and saying, here's me, here's what I know, here's my website. So that was a big step for me.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I mean, you certainly do have years and years of leadership. So, and it's definitely a library to publish.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I've got a third book I'm working on now, and I contributed a chapter to a new leadership book coming out in October, which was written by a former quarterback of the Naval Academy. And he wrote a book, and it's called The Experience of Leadership. And it's 12 different chapters, 12 different leaders. And we share our stories in this book. So excited about that one coming out. So, but yeah, we've got, it's been fun. And I, through the process of writing, I've met a lot of great people. Like you, I started a podcast, and I realized that people weren't reading articles anymore. So I took my, I still write articles once a week, but then I made them shorter, and I spend more time on podcasts now and talking like we're doing right now. I just enjoy this format, and it's nice because it's portable. People can listen to you, in their cars, in the gym, while they're cutting the lawn. So yeah, so I really enjoy teaching and writing on the subject of leadership, and it's all based on, the experiences you had in the Navy and I had in the Navy. Yeah.
All right, John. One last question. Well, two last questions. Your social media looks kind of like mine is. Mine's all Veterans and Wild, anywhere you can find me. If I'm on that platform, Veterans and Wild. Yours, though, is John S. Rennie.
Yes.
And you point that out, so there's a reason for that. What's the S, or is that family?
Oh, important? It's funny. What's it's great that you say that. So here's the deal. Everybody's listening, or you're thinking about, creating a brand for yourself or your name for yourself. You ought to own a website with your own name on it, right? I just encourage it. So I went to go buy johnrennie.com, and that's when I realized that it was owned already. Okay. And it would have cost me like thousands of dollars to buy it from the guy that owned johnrennie.com.
Yes.
And so I said, well, you know what? Is John S. Rennie, Scott's my middle name is Scott. And it's like, is John S. Rennie available? sure enough, it was, and it was really cheap. So I'm like, yes, that's it. So I became johnsrennie.com, and everything on my social media is all John S. Rennie. Yeah. And then the thing is, I actually own, my name is spelled J-O-N, and I actually own J-O-H-N-S-Rennie.com. So I own John S. Rennie and John S. Rennie. And if you go to either one, it goes to my website. So it doesn't matter how you spell my name, it gets there. But the point is that that it was to save money, and that's just who I am. Like, all my books are John S. Rennie, and that's how people know me. And I'm the only John S. Rennie that I know of on social media. So, you know, that's what I did. So it's a good tip. Those of you who are named John Doe, you know, use your middle name. So.
All right. That was less climatic than I thought.
Oh, okay. No, it's not. It's not. It's not very. No, it doesn't mean submarine or anything like that, or shipmate, or, you know, I don't know.
It's, I guess, just, the importance to me was the reason I joined the Navy was my grandfather named Stanley. My sons are both named for a grandfather of theirs. My second son is named for my grandfather Stanley, who's in World War II. So I was like, what is this S? And you're like, nothing.
Literally my little middle name. But
you're like, it was cheaper to buy the website.
I wish I had it. Yeah. It's like you want, like, every time you get injured, you want a cool story of how you get injured, but mostly it's slipping in the bathtub or something. Right. So that's one of those situations where it's not as exciting as it could have been. Yeah. So it's just, that's just my middle name.
I'm not going to publish this podcast.
No, you don't have to. It's fine.
No, I had all these hopes, John. No, but really, I did really enjoy this whole podcast, John. Wow. You've had a great career. One last question, though. You met Mr. Colin Powell.
Yeah, yeah. How cool is that? Why? Yeah, so... So the Tennessee, the ship boat I was on, we made in the history of our country, we made the 3,000th strategic deterrent patrol. So 3,000 patrols happened, and I happened to be on the 3,000th. It's kind of a hard thing to say. And so when we got back, there was a big ceremony, and everybody from the Joint Chiefs of Staff all the way down to my commanding officer. So my entire chain of command came out for the ceremony. It was a big deal. But at the end of the, but I didn't realize until later on that it was a bigger celebration. It was the first major celebration after the Cold War ended. So this was about 3 months after the Cold War ended. This was the first major celebration. And that's why Colin Powell came out. That's why the entire chain of command was there. And I can tell you this is that, and it was interesting because we were in dress whites. And I didn't even know the Army had dress whites. Colin Powell was in dress whites. He had a dress white uniform for the event. And
I didn't know that either.
Oh, it's wild. And his speech that day, I put part of his speech that day in my latest book. And obviously he was well briefed, but he really spoke to the life of a naval officer, the life of a naval sailor on submarines. And he was well briefed, but it was a great speech, great day. And it was a big ceremony. And again, I didn't realize it was a celebration at the end of the end of the Cold War. And we were part of that. And we helped close that chapter. And it was a big freaking deal. But I didn't know it was a big deal at the time, because that was the day. And you'll know the importance of this, that I got my dolphins. That's the day I pinned on my dolphins. Most important day outside the birth of my children and my marriage was that day when I got my dolphins. And I'll never forget it. And you know, it's a brotherhood, you know, same thing with a surface warfare officer pin. It's a brotherhood. You put those dolphins on, you're part of an elite club, an elite team. And it's one of the most important days of my life. So.
Yeah, that's really kind of crazy. It happened the same day. That's.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I'm still kind of like, oh.
Well, it's funny because I was looking at some pictures of myself from that day, and I look rail thin. I look like I hadn't slept in months. My uniform looked two sizes too big for me. And that was what life was like, being unqualified on a submarine. And you were yep. You were under pressure to get qualified. And I busted my tail. And And I looked like almost a POW because I just was a shell of myself because I was just focused on getting those dolphins and getting through that patrol and getting qualified. And so it was a really important day in my life.
So was the ceremony part of?
No, it took place. Mr. We took Pelican. Place after. It took place after the big hoopla event. We had a smaller event up on the back of the boat, and we had a dolphin pinning. Me and a buddy got our pins that day. So
yeah. I was gonna say, like, did Colin Powell put the dolphins on?
No, my wife did. No. Well, it's funny because I had this fantasy. I know. I had this fantasy of when I wrote my second book, I had a fantasy of somehow getting Colin Powell to write the foreword to it. Yes. Only because I feel like I have this bond with him, but like I was just somebody on that boat. Like he doesn't know who I am. But would have been cool if he did the forward to it, because he's a really great, he's written a lot of books on leadership and he speaks a lot on leadership. So I really do like his views on leadership. Would have been great, but I decided not to pursue that avenue. So,
well, you have a third book coming out.
I do. Yeah. This one's more of a journal, leadership journal. And a lot of people said my first book was like almost like a daily leadership devotion, because the stories are short. And so what I decided to do is took some of the stories from the first book and the second book, and I put it in a journal, and it's going to be like 5 days a week for a year. It'll give you exercises to do, and each week will be a different theme. So as a leader, a young leader coming into an organization, these, you know, kind of check yourself on some areas, like, are you doing these things? Are you avoiding these things? And it's just speaking from my years of experience. So it's called You Have the Watch, Becoming a Leader Worth Following. So it's kind of a spin on I Have the Watch. So,
yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
But I think Mr. Powell's still available for a forward.
Oh, I'm sure he is. But like I said, maybe it's because I fear rejection, but I also think that I'm nobody, you know, and I just feel like, you know, like this guy's been like everything, you know, Secretary of State and, you know, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. So I'm nobody to him. So I'm just some JO, right?
Well, yeah. Going back even further to share one last story. I, as you did ROTC, and the way we made all of our money to do all of our things was at Penn State. They draw a crowd of 106,000 people five times a year. And that draws, you know, nearly the budget of two or three states.
Yes.
Especially 20 years ago when they had a program ran by a man that I liked. I was, you know, the other side of the barrier gates to watch him walk by me. And it was just kind of like,
ah. Yeah.
And it's kind of the same thing when you were like, you saw it, like Colin Powell, and it was kind of like,
Yeah.
And obviously, I mean, my guy's been gone for 10 years now. He's been dead. But same kind of thing. Like, you kind of wish like you could have had more interaction, or like if I could ask that guy questions. But I did see my father and I, as I said, my dad went to that school. All four of his kids went to that school. My dad and I did get to go see his son speak.
Oh, wow.
In like a group setting of like 50 or 75 people. And he took questions at the end. And one of the things, which is really cool, because I was there with my dad. So the question I asked him about his father, I asked him, I said, what was, you know, your father was so unknown. What was some of the best memories you had with your father professionally and then family? And it was so fun to hear those sort of things.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's neat. Unfortunately, I didn't get to spend too much time with him, but I would have loved to pick his brain and would have loved to have him do the foreword of that book because he's in it, you know. Yep. But anyways, it's a good experience, and it was fun to write about, and it was fun to reminisce on it. And I was really surprised how much I could find on the internet, because you know, your brain You're like, I can't remember like what happened that day, but it was such an important day in our history that there's so much stuff on the web that I could find his whole speech and I could find photos, AP photos were in, you know, I'm like, oh, cool. Hey, there's me on the, you know, on the, so it's kind of cool. So I found a lot of good historical information that I included in the book. Just because it was a unique, partner history. So, yeah.
And it's out next month.
All in the Same Boat's been out since May, and it's available on Amazon, or you can buy it on my website. So it's out there. It's been a bestseller. It's been selling really well, and a lot of people are interested in submarines and leadership. So yeah.
No, sorry. I know that one's out. The third book. You said
October. Third book. No, third book is still it's available for pre-sale on my website, but it's not quite done yet.
Oh, okay.
I'm still working on it.
I thought I heard in October and I was like, wow, that's soon.
Yeah. It should have been out last October, but anyways, I'm working on it. So
it's coming. Yes.
I would say this, everything is written. I'm just trying to put it all in the right, you know, format.
One sentence here. There's another one there.
Right. Right.
Awesome, John. That's great. And we look forward to that book. So again, John Astrani, I think that's the best place to find you everywhere.
Yeah, johnastrani.com, and you can get links to all my socials there. And I'm very active on Twitter, got an Instagram account, all that fun stuff. But yeah, I think johnastrani.com, you can reach out to me, you can email me there. For those of you listening, I mean, I do public speaking too. If you ever want me to come out to your team and talk about this kind of stuff, I'm happy to do it. And I'm really, this is my hobby. You know, I run a manufacturing business full time, and this is my writing books and talking on leadership is my hobby, and I enjoy it. And I absolutely love being on podcasts like this, talking to people like you, just kind of, especially love this reminiscing about the days, you know, the days in the Navy, and, you know, we both shared very similar experiences. So this is fun stuff. I enjoy it. So yeah, please reach out to me. I'm happy to, answer questions or even come talk about it. So.
Awesome. Thank you, John. We've loved having you here.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you very much, Adam.
Yep. Take care.